It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an iHeart Original.
Content warning. This episode discusses cyberbullying and suicide.
I would always say, Meg, relationships online are not real relationships because you truly don't know who the other person is, right? We can be whoever we want to be. You know, there was a time where Josh put Megan's picture on his profile, like a big picture, and said, this is my girlfriend. And I looked at it and I was like, whoa, Megan, tell him to get that picture off of there. I said, Meg, I don't know. This something doesn't seem right. And she was like, what do you mean, Mom?
I'm Joanne McNeil, and this is Main Accounts, the story of MySpace. Episode 6, Megan's story. From the beginning, MySpace was a social network open to experimentation. People with fake identities who used it anonymously could participate on MySpace side by side with users who logged in with their real names and posted pictures of themselves. But there were a number of reasons why someone wouldn't have wanted their real name on MySpace. Valid reasons. Maybe you were a queer kid in a small town and wanted to be able to chat on MySpace with other queer people without getting outed. Or maybe you had a stalker who would further harass you if they found your MySpace profile. Or maybe you just wanted to sign up for an account with the name of one of the replicants in Blade Runner, like one of the fakesters on Friendster did, because it's fun and kind of funny. The fluid nature of digital identity on MySpace made the experience special. But for a parent with kids using MySpace, there were real fears about imposters.
The story of Megan Meyer created a nationwide furor. Just shy of her 14th birthday, she became a member of MySpace.com. Megan had a history of attention deficit disorder and depression, but she was elated when she met 16-year-old Josh Evans online, a handsome stranger who showered her with compliments.
The moral panic over online predators on MySpace was largely overblown. But there was some truth to these fears. There were abductions. There were musicians hitting on 14-year-old, 13-year-olds, even 11-year-old fans. These stories ended up on the nightly news and further stoked people's fears about who was actually behind various MySpace profiles. And one story, the biggest scandal MySpace had faced yet, showed how the use of a fake account could result in circumstances confusing and surreal and tragic beyond belief. The story of Megan Meyer.
Megan was from the moment she was born, the kid that just moved nonstop and was always curious about things, wanted to know about things. She had this amazing sense of humor. She could make me laugh till I had tears rolling down my face. It didn't matter if I was in the store, if I was driving, where I was at. She was so funny. And, you know, she loved scary movies. She loved music, all kinds of music. She liked All American Rejects. She loved Bow Wow. She loved Beyonce. She loved so many different artists back in the day. Hip hop was definitely one of her biggest things that she loved. She had a kind of a mixture of where she was very girly, but then she also could take a worm off of a hook, where like I could never do something like that. Her laughter to me was like what I miss, one of the biggest things I miss about her is her laughter.
Like many young girls in the aughts, Megan loved talking on the internet. When she discovered MySpace, she instantly wanted her own account.
When Megan started with wanting to have a MySpace account was when she was going into eighth grade. And I was a nervous wreck about it. And I also watched the news. I watched 2020 and How to Catch a Predator. So, you know, my fear was sexual predators. On top of the fact that I had a kid who had struggled for so long with her self-esteem and self-worth that I was worried that somebody could say something nice to Megan and, you know, get her to meet them at the mall or go to the movies. Those were things that I was always concerned with.
Megan first set up an account when she was staying with a friend at a relative's house. They set up a fake account together.
It made me realize that they can have access anywhere. Like, this is really scary. And, you know, even putting her picture out there, not knowing who the other person was. So I tried explaining to Megan about, you know, we need to get this shut down. This is not okay to put a fake picture out there. I understand that you finally told them that this is really you, but that's not the way it's going to work. Megan begged me to not cut her off from these two boys that she had talked to. I really had a hard time because I needed to know that these boys were real. So I told her I needed their phone numbers, their parents' number. And I did talk to both of the parents.
Tina didn't want Megan using MySpace. Still, she let her daughter set up an account.
I knew Megan. If I didn't, Megan would find a way. Believe me, she would have found a way.
Tina set some ground rules. The account was in Megan's name, but only Tina knew the password to it. Megan could only use MySpace on the shared computer in the living room and never on a laptop alone in her bedroom.
And I even purchased this program that was called WatchRite way back in the day. And it came in a disc in the mail and it would monitor every instant message and every website that she visited.
This meant that Tina monitored every time Megan logged into MySpace. She could see every friend request that Megan got. There was nothing Megan could do on the social network without Tina's permission.
She told me that I was a warden of a prison, that there was no other parent as strict as I was, that it was pretty embarrassing. And, you know, I said, I get it. I do. I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about other people.
One day, Megan got a friend request from a teenage boy named Josh Evans.
And Megan looked at me and she's like, Mom, can I add him? Please, he is so hot. So I said, Meg, who is he? Is he a friend of a friend or how do you know him? She goes like, Mom, I don't know. He's just hot, please. And I said, Megan, here's the thing. I will let you add him, but if there's anything negative, anything sexual, he is deleted immediately. And she said, okay, I promise.
Tina was skeptical, but she let Megan add Josh as a friend.
The reason is that I knew if I did not allow her to add somebody, she was going to do it behind my back. She would have went to a library. She would have went to a friend's house. She would have created a fake one again. I wouldn't know about it because now she would know how to erase all of her history. And I thought at least if I did it this way, I could monitor it if there's any issues.
Josh and Megan got close really fast. He told her she was beautiful. It meant a lot to Megan, who had been insecure about her looks since kindergarten. Josh even put Megan's photo up on his top 8 and called her his girlfriend.
How do I know you?
You don't. I just thought you were pretty cute.
This worried Tina. She reached out to a friend of Megan's who was good with computers and asked whether Josh's photo was real. It was real, the friend said, but there's something creepy about it. And that really troubled Tina.
Me being the mom I was, I called the police. And I wanted to know, can I find out if a MySpace profile is real or not? And they said, you know, you need to go to call cybercrimes. So then I called cybercrimes. And they had said, you know, has anybody tried soliciting? Is there... Or have you met somebody? Any of those? I said, no, it's just something doesn't feel right. Well, listen, lady, we don't have enough people there to be able to monitor all of these accounts because this was so brand new at the time.
When Megan was at school, Tina wrote to Josh on MySpace using Megan's account, which only she had the password for, and she asked him to stop messaging her daughter. Megan was furious.
And she made me promise, Mom, that is embarrassing. Please don't comment on anything until I'm home. I said, okay, I will make the deal with you. Because again, I was trying to keep this balance between her trust and her not going and creating a fake account where I didn't know. But balancing that. So I said, I promise, I will not open, I will not do anything, we'll turn the notifications off. That way, it will only be opened up when you get home.
After the break, Josh and Megan continue to grow close, while the mystery of his identity turns into a threat.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Josh and Megan continue to exchange messages for several weeks.
Lucky me and lucky you, because you are my number one.
He was often evasive. Still, Josh was attentive and engaging when he wrote to Megan.
I went to the mall.
What mall did you go to? Maybe we can meet and go to the mall or the movies.
Oh, I don't remember what mall.
But then, without warning, Josh's feelings changed.
I don't know if I want to be friends with you anymore because I've heard that you are not very nice to your friends.
Megan asked her mother what could be going on with Josh. Tina told her, "You know, some people just have bad days." It was confusing for Megan, but she seemed to have brushed Josh's comments off. Plus, Megan was busy. She had her 14th birthday party coming up.
The next day, Megan went to school. She was in a great mood, handed out her invitations. I picked her up. All of her friends were coming to her birthday party. And then she asks to sign on to MySpace.
Megan logged into MySpace to find more messages from Josh, accusing her of being unkind to her friends.
"I heard you're not nice to your friends, and I don't want to be friends with you anymore."
"Okay, how about no? Tell me who they are. And yeah, so whatever. You know, you ain't too nice yourself."
Typically, I always made sure she signed off, but it was raining really hard that day. I had to go grab her sister and I left. I called Megan two different times from the orthodontist office. Both times she was crying. The last time she was sobbing where I couldn't even understand her. And I said, "Please get off the MySpace." I came home. Megan was still sobbing at the computer, and I said, "Let me sit down." And I was tired and frustrated as a mom. I had been running all day. My other daughter was crying because her braces were tightened. Megan was crying because of this. There was still dinner, homework, showers, all of that. And when I sat down and looked at the computer, there were messages that went from Josh to Megan, Megan to Josh.
Megan was defending herself, but Josh's messages were cruel.
"Fat ass. Whore. The world would be a better off place without you in it."
One of her friends called the home phone, and Megan picked it up and was crying and just said, I have to talk to you later. And she ran upstairs to her room. I tried looking at a little bit more of what happened, but I went upstairs into the kitchen and her dad came downstairs and said, "What is going on?" He started cooking dinner and we were talking about what was going on, and he didn't like anything to do with her taking photos, anything on the MySpace, anything to do with any of that. 20 minutes later, I just had a horrible feeling that ran through my entire body. I stopped in mid-sentence and ran up to her room. I opened the door and I found Megan hanging in her closet. I screamed. Her dad came upstairs. I tried finding the phone. The weird part of it was is that as I was trying to dial out her home phone to 911, my younger daughter, Allison, was calling to see if dinner was ready to come home because she was across the street, and I was frantically screaming to hang up the phone. And I had to run around and find my cell phone to call. And as I was dialing and calling 911, Ron, Megan's dad, was giving her CPR, and Allison ran home in the midst of all of it. Megan was not breathing. The paramedics arrived. They got Megan's heart started and got her to start breathing with assistance. And there was a small glimmer of hope of maybe she's going to make it through.
Megan was taken to the children's hospital. She couldn't be revived.
But going home, I couldn't go back to our house. We went and stayed at my mom's house. And I think it was trying to figure out, like, how does this happen?
It felt unreal. Tina's grief was overwhelming. And as Tina began to ruminate on the circumstances leading up to Megan's death, she kept going back to that one MySpace user, Josh Evans. He deleted his account the night Megan took her life.
And I couldn't figure out, like, what happened. I was like, is it a kid that was scared, or was it an adult? And now that the Josh Evans photo was gone, I sat there for hours throughout the night, throughout the day, searching for, like, who was this person? Where did they go? What happened? And no matter what I did, I couldn't find anything. Like, it just all disappeared.
Thanksgiving weekend, the family's first Thanksgiving without Megan. Tina and Ron Meyer were set to go to their grief support group for parents who have lost a child to suicide. It was just over a month after Megan passed. The phone rang.
We got a call from a neighbor that I didn't know very well, saying that she had to talk to me about Megan's death. And I was kind of, like, taken back and almost a little bit frustrated, thinking, I really don't know you. You're calling me on this weekend. I'm going to a grief support group. I don't know what to tell you. I don't want to sit there and listen to you asking questions about Megan's death. And then we got another call. And this call was from a man that lived in our subdivision who was a counselor, who did talk to Ron and I during these times and said, Tina, it is really important for you guys to attend this meeting. Do you have any other, you know, your parents, anybody that can be there to support you guys?
It was confusing. But Tina and Ron knew this neighbor, assumed he had the best intentions, and went to the gathering while not entirely sure what it was about. When the Myers arrived, they saw acquaintances of theirs sitting in chairs set up in a circle.
And I walked in and I said, so you're going to tell me that the Josh Evans account was fake? Is that what you're going to tell me? And then they told me that Lori Drew, in our subdivision, her daughter created this fake MySpace account as a hoax to be able to trick Megan.
I don't know if I
want to be friends with you anymore. Because I've heard that you're not very nice to your friends.
Lori Drew wasn't even hiding her involvement in setting up the fake account with her daughter and her daughter's friend. Lori told acquaintances that the Josh Evans account had been a prank to retaliate for Megan once calling her daughter names. She sounded, if not proud, in no way contrite. Mind you, this is after the suicide of 13-year-old Megan. One of the neighbors found out, because her daughter was in extracurriculars with Lori Drew's daughter, that neighbor knew she had to do something. Tina had to know.
The mom kept pressuring Lori Drew to please come forward and talk to us. She contacted a church. She contacted the police department, contacted anybody and everybody and said, this family needs to know what happened. And this was her final solution to try to do something so that we knew. And when we found out, I think there was calls made to our other family. And I think they were worried that Ron was going to go down and kill them because this family lived four houses down the street. I think Ron was more in shock, where I was so angry. All I thought about doing was going and ripping them apart. That's all I wanted to do. And when we drove back home, we had family and neighbors kind of blocking the street so that we could not go down to the Drew's house, Lori Drew's house. And we pulled in the driveway and everybody was hysterical. Our family, our neighbors, everybody was sobbing, hysterical, emotions were everywhere. Everybody from one person that would say, no, don't go down there, the other person would completely lose it and want to go down there. And I tried running down there several times and was held back.
The Myers and the Drews had been neighbors. They knew each other. Tina and Ron were even hiding a foosball table in their garage for the Drews so they could surprise their kids with it at Christmas. Lori Drew had gone to Megan's wake and funeral.
This was also the same woman that when after Megan died, we went and knocked on their door and told Sarah, because we wanted her to know, to try to make sure she could be okay. The same family that invited us to Sarah's birthday party to come down to their house to sing and have cake, which was 3 days after Megan's birthday, to sit there and watch us in absolute misery.
Tina and Ron thought about the foosball table that they were holding for the Drews.
We grabbed, it sounds ridiculous now, but we grabbed the foosball table and one of us had a sledgehammer, one of us had an axe, and we destroyed the foosball table, put it in the back of Ron's truck. The big cardboard box, I spray painted Merry Christmas on it. We drove down the street, we unloaded it all behind their van and put the box there, came back home, and Lori Drew, her husband, and Sarah Drew, they sent Sarah in front of them, walked down the sidewalk with their hands in the air of, what's going on? What's happening? And they had our neighbors went and told them if they knew what was good for them, that they would leave and go home. They sent then Laura or Sarah Drew, the 14-year-old now, to our front door to knock on our door to talk to us. And Ron told her to go home. Do not come back here again. Go home. Lori Drew then called the police department to file charges against us for destruction of personal property. And at that time is when Lori Drew told the police department, the police officer in the police report, why all of this was happening. That she created a fake account to gain Megan's confidence to find out if Megan was talking about her daughter behind her back. And that is the sole reason.
Lori Drew confessed, but it didn't change the fact that Megan was gone. And her loss had major repercussions. Losing Megan took a toll on Tina and Ron's marriage. They had been high school sweethearts. But trauma changes relationships. People don't always grieve the same way. They separated in 2007. And in addition to the grief, Tina felt incredible rage toward the Drews.
I would literally go back home and pray at night to give me the strength to not go down to hurt them, because I would see them driving on the streets, taking their kids to school, acting like life was just normal again. And when I don't hide anything, I am very transparent. There were, when I talk about losing your mind, when I saw them drive down the street, I would try to run them off the road, like literally try to run them off the road. Everything inside of me, you could feel normal for a second, and then I would see them and it would take over me, this rage of how dare you just go on about your life when you've done all this.
What Lori Drew did to Megan was beyond Tina's imagination. It felt like a crime. It had to be a crime, Tina thought. She reached out to lawyers and spoke with the FBI.
The hope was at that time that if there was not going to be vengeance and they were not going to feel the pain, then there needed to be justice. Something needed to be done because I didn't want another family going through this.
The FBI got a hold of every message from the Drew households to the Meyer households. They were treating the circumstances around Megan's death seriously, but the investigation went nowhere.
They felt no one could prosecute it, and I thought, what are we supposed to do now? And I remember the one FBI agent who was phenomenal. He said, Tina, don't give up. Don't give up. Get the laws changed. I thought, okay, great. How do you do that?
Around this time, Tina got in touch with a journalist in St. Louis. He started working on a story about Megan's death.
I thought, this finally is going to get Lori Drew's name out there, right? This finally is going to get everybody to see, because in between this time, it's about a year, there were people that thought that we just were trying to blame people for Megan's death. Like, we were trying to push blame on somebody else, and really it must have been us. And I wanted to, like, clear Megan's name. I wanted people to know. And he refused, or his publisher refused, to release Lori's true name. I was not happy. And I told him how unhappy I was about it. You know, I get why they have to do certain things through protection of children, and I get all of that now. But I was not happy. But the reality is that one newspaper article that went out got the attention of a blogger out of state. The blogger out of state contacted the journalist and started pushing this out. And all of the things that I ever wanted to be able to do to the Drews, everybody, they all did this. I mean, they, people that found out about this and read about it and heard about it, because now it's, you know, in newspapers and on blogs. And that was even before the big viral, you know, where everything went viral. You know, we had news stations and national media and all of that were starting to come about wanting to hear about the story. You know, back then, when a local news station, we called them about the story, they said, we don't do suicide, especially on youth. We don't do those stories.
Megan's death and what happened on MySpace was being discussed all around the world. Tina was regularly speaking with the media. One day in January of 2008, over a year after Megan passed, Tina got a call from a reporter.
And they said, are you aware about the indictment of Lori Drew? And I was like, what? I have no clue what you're talking about. They said, well, a federal grand jury indicted Lori Drew.
It was the first Tina had heard about the indictment.
And I said, okay, I don't know anything about it. So I got off the phone and one of the producers from the Today Show called and said, Tina, can you get on a plane in an hour? I'm like, I am back over at my old house. I am in the process of cleaning out Megan's room. It was horribly hard to do. My hair is in a ponytail, I'm in sweatpants, and you want me to get on a plane.
If it did happen to her, then some have said you'd have to prosecute a lot of people, because a lot of people create these phony sites for very innocent reasons. So is it really fair?
Well, you know what? Innocent reasons, I don't see any innocent reasons. And I think that what it would do is people would shut them down pretty quickly. And I think it would be a good statement for people to say, you know what? This is not okay. Making any type of a false MySpace account or Facebook account or any account is not okay. You're still defrauding somebody, whether you're finding out if it's a cheating boyfriend, girlfriend, whether you're doing it as a joke to play with somebody. Any of those things, to falsify it, you're doing it in a way that's not truthful, and it doesn't need to be done. I remember my aunt, when I would be like, I can't do another interview. I cannot do another TV show. I cannot do this anymore. I'm exhausted. She would say, Tina, what if there's another Megan out there? What if there's another you out there?
Megan would have been 30 years old this year. The foundation Tina set up in her honor, the Megan Meyer Foundation, is still going strong. But this was just the beginning of the media firestorm. There was a trial, and Lori Drew was eventually acquitted. But what happened next set in motion events that would lead to MySpace's eventual collapse. More on this in the next episode of Main Accounts. Thanks for listening to Main Accounts, the story of MySpace, an iHeart original podcast. Main Accounts, the story of MySpace, is written and hosted by me, Joanne McNeil. Editing and sound design by Mike Coscarelli and Mary Dew. Original music by Elise McCoy. Mixing and mastering by Josh Fisher. Research and fact-checking by Austin Thompson, Jocelyn Sears, and Marissa Brown. Show logo by Lucy Quintanilla. Special thanks to Ryan Murdoch, Grace Views, and Bahid Frazier. Our associate producer is Lauren Phillip. Our senior producer is Mike Coscarelli. And our executive producer is Jason English. If you're enjoying the show, leave us a rating and a review on your favorite podcast platform. Sadly, my MySpace page is no longer around, but you can find me on Twitter at Joe Mick. Let us hear your MySpace story. And check out my book, Lurking. Main Accounts, the story of MySpace, is a production of iHeart Podcasts.
It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, Centratech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.